Michael and I got married on a beautiful day in June. We'd been best friends for 18 years, and our three children had grown up together, so we decided that we really didn't want to have a big wedding. All we wanted to do was have a few friends and family members together and enjoy the day. We were going to get married at the outdoor chapel at Camp Chippewa. And that was going to be followed by a barbecue and games. It was going to be so much fun. And then the church secretary discovered our plans. "We've never married off a preacher," she said, "and you're not going to deprive us of the privilege." The mother of the bride had spoken. Now, the outdoor wedding was obviously off. But I insisted that if she was going to plan my wedding, there was going to be two rules. It was going to be simple, and it was going to be fun. And if at all possible, we really wanted the barbecue. Now, allowing an entire congregation to plan a wedding is a scary thought. We decided for our own sanity, we'd just step back and let them have it. And I must admit that the mother of the bride did a fairly good job of obeying the two rules. She kept it simple. She kept it fun. She also tried to get the barbecue, but the tents were too expensive and the smoker was out of the question. When the day finally arrived, she and her sister got up early in the morning and they went tramping around somewhere known only to them and got enough daylilies to fill the entire fellowship hall. They had filled containers with cute little things and, well, the day, it was really going to be perfect. Right up to the moment when Joshua, bless his heart, called to report that his pants didn't fit. Now, why he hadn't tried them on a week earlier when we had given to them was beyond us. But what we discovered was it was a generational thing. Dustin and Andrew hadn't tried their pants on either. With a little bit of ingenuity, we did get Dustin's pants to fit Andrew, which meant we only had to find two pair of charcoal gray pants that matched, that could be altered. But not to worry, we had 3 hours to do it in. Maybe it was four. So while Michael was with the men in Topeka trying to find the pants, I was in Overbrook trying to get everything else together. He called to say they were on their way, and yes, the men had pants that fit. So I went over to the church to get dressed. Now, bless my sister's heart, I know she was only trying to help, but why didn't she put the towel on my dress before she tried to steam it? Rust stains. All the way down the front. I was beginning to think it wasn't worth it. The 4 o'clock came. And everyone was there. The men could sit down, their pants fit them. I had managed to get the rust stains out of the front of my dress. And what was really miraculous is everyone was still speaking. Actually, we were having a lot of fun. We were laughing and joking. Now, the day had obviously gone from strange to downright weird. And maybe that's why when Elvis walked in, the usher didn't bat an eye. He greeted him, sat him down in a pew next to two of the oldest women in the congregation, who smiled politely at him and asked him how he was doing. He went through the reception line. He got into the food line. And everyone who saw him greeted him warmly, chatted with him for a while, and then went on about their business. And not one person asked either one of us what on earth he was doing there. It seemed perfectly normal that Elvis would come to your wedding. Now, to be honest with you, it wasn't until our wedding that today's gospel story ever raised a question in my mind. But thinking about Elvis and reading about Jesus, friends, the wedding at Cana, it occurred when Jesus was about 30 years old. Cana was probably 3 miles from Nazareth. Tradition says that the bridegroom was probably related to his mother, Mary. And so they were invited to the wedding. Jesus was 30 years old, the Messiah of the world. And no one wondered what he was doing there. Not one guest was surprised when Jesus walked in. I mean, here was a man who had grown up in their midst, who had probably played with the bridegroom as a child, who had been an obnoxious adolescent, who had argued with them, who had questioned people's authority, who was now a man ready to start the greatest ministry in the world, and no one wondered what he was doing there. Now, why was that? You would have thought that somewhere in those 30 years, someone would have discovered the truth. Someone would have started wondering why Jesus was so different from everyone else. Yet when we catch this small glimpse of Jesus's lost years, it becomes strangely apparent that no one in his hometown or even in his family thought of Jesus as being particularly religious. If they had, I will guarantee you as a pastor, their reaction would have been a whole lot different when he walked in on a drunken bash. Think John the Baptist. Now there was a man who could have thrown a real damper into any celebration. Yet people from all over the countryside were going out into the desert to hear John proclaim the word of the Lord. But after 30 years, even Jesus' own brother refused to join him in his ministry. No one took him seriously. As a matter of fact, the scriptures tell us it wasn't until after he turned the water into wine that Jesus' own disciples even believed in him. And just to make the whole matter even more confusing, we're told that this was the first of his signs. But what was it a sign of? Christians, think about it. We make it too difficult. Do you know why he turned the water into wine? Because he cared for the bridegroom and his family. He cared so much that he wanted to spare them the humiliation and disgrace of failing. That's it. He cared for him. He loved him. And he would have done anything for them. And that's the way he wants to care for us too. He wants to be a part of our everyday. He wants to be there when the pants don't fit, when the kids are misbehaving, when we're alone and afraid. He wants to be there. He wants to love us and care for us. But for that to happen, we have to let him off the cross and into our lives. We have to take him off the altar and stop treating him like he's some iconoclastic God who can't be touched. We have to become so close to him that when we turn around and find him standing there, we don't even wonder why. He's not so holy that we can't touch him. And he's not so good that he doesn't want to touch us too. In his book, Life from the Upside, J. Ellsworth Kalash wrote, "Sometimes when I look out on a congregation, I'm disturbed by the many faces I see. I'm not speaking of persons who carry heavy loads. In truth, I've learned that the burdened people don't necessarily look burdened and distressed. I'm thinking of those persons who look at church as if it's a root canal experience with no anesthesia. For such persons, I wish Jesus would suddenly appear and let them know that his faith, that this faith they profess to follow, is full of life. Abundant life. I'm with Teresa of Avila, who prayed to be delivered from all the frowning saints." In truth, of course, frowning saints is an oxymoron. Saints have found the springs of laughter. When the wine runs out, when the party goes flat, when it seems as though the day is more of a chore than a joy, don't be surprised if Jesus shows up. And when he does, let him in. What you'll discover is that he cares deeply for you and for everything you feel. And in his caring, he will bring the celebration of joy into the most unexpected, unappreciated, and unwelcoming moments in our lives. Oh, friends, think of everything he could add to our lives if only we'd let him in. To God be the glory. Amen.